commencing countdown.
3, 2, 1.
This is The Contracting Experience.
Connecting government contracting professionals to the world around them through conversations with acquisition influencers, insights into evolving hot topics, and sharing lessons learned from the field.
Welcome, podcast listeners. On this episode of The Contracting Experience, we sit down with Mr. Tom Wells, a retired member of the Senior Executive Service, who has over 35 years of Air Force acquisition-related experience and has held such esteemed positions as Director of Contracting for Air Force Materiel Command, as well as the Director of the 711th Human Performance Wing. Mr. Wells has remained active in the government acquisition arena and currently serves as Vice President and Senior Associate at Dayton Aerospace, where he provides senior-level support and delivers acquisition training for both government and industry acquisition professionals. Mr. Wells comes to us today to share his experiences and insights over the years from sitting on both sides of the negotiation table and gives us a small glimpse into the training he provides to produce win-win arrangements in an efficient and quality manner. Welcome, Mr. Tom Wells. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you again, Rob. This is really a great initiative, publishing podcasts for the contracting community. It's by sharing our stories and experiences that we grow both personally and professionally. Kudos to you.
Oh, thank you, sir. And again, I inherited the podcast from Ms. Amber Pecoraro about 5 episodes ago. Amber was the brainchild on this, and almost 150,000 downloads over 50 episodes. So, yeah, it really has quite a following. Really happy you can join us today to continue the great things we have going. So,
I'm ready.
All righty, let's dive in. So, Mr. Wells, with over 35 years in government acquisition, I imagine you're a lot like that insurance commercial that says, you know, they know a lot of things because they've seen a lot of things. Can you share a couple instances of what has changed over the years in government acquisition and maybe what's remained the same or stood the test of time?
So, Rob, the biggest thing I've seen is a growing pressure to get things done quickly. And that has provided us a lot of new ways of buying. Going back to the 2000s when we really got into commercial products and services, and then eventually when that started as a test and then became a permanent program to use simplified acquisition procedures up to $7.5 million. I mean, that's an awesome flexibility that we were provided. Now, the downside of that is all the laws and regulations that have continued to be levied on commercial purchasing, and that makes it hard for contractors who are truly in the competitive business to take advantage of that. Another area is the widespread use of IDIQ contracts, especially the multiple award contracts. And I read just recently, I even missed this, you don't even have to consider price in your evaluation of who's going to win a contract if you're going to give a contract to all qualified sources. So that's another thing that speeds things up. And of course, strategic sourcing, that's huge. Moving from that more tactical buying to strategic contracts and work in demand management inside the organizations. And most recently, the explosive growth and use of other transactions to award non-FAR based agreements, along with those flexible solicitation and assessment types of devices like commercial solutions openings and contest, and to win prizes as a contract if you win the contest, which is really fascinating. In terms of what hasn't changed, back in 2000, no, it was in the 1990s, I believe, I wrote down 12 enduring principles for contract professionals. And I first wrote it down in a public speaking engagement in 2001 at an NCMA meeting. And those principles are still valid today. But I could talk about that for a while. So maybe a future podcast on that one.
No, that's a great teaser, sir. Yeah, thanks for that. I'm making a note as we speak, 12 enduring principles. I love it. And yeah, getting back, you mentioned just, we have gotten a lot more creative over the years, right? Keeping up with the speed of relevance. You mentioned the assistance agreements. We have the consortium contracting, the commercial solicitations. So we're doing a lot there, and it's more than just a nice to have or speeding things up, right? With the operational imperatives, with the great power competition, it's really, we just owe it to our stakeholders, right? Speed of relevance, getting things out there in a timely manner while still getting that good business deal.
Absolutely.
All right. So, sir, on a personal note, we've crossed paths several times over the years. I've had the pleasure of being on your team a couple different times. We met each other while you assisted me on my APIT thesis. I then followed you over to Joint Stars, the Legacy Electronic System Center. A few years ago, we were reunited again at the 7-Eleventh Human Performance Wing. So I share that history just to sort of level set the stage on something you said several years ago that has really stuck with me. So back during the BRAC transition, that might ring a bell with you, sir. Mm-hmm. We're moving a lot of legacy work from Brooks Air Force Base up to Wright-Patterson. In the meantime, we had a major source selection that was sort of changing contracting offices midstream. So we were at the table for one of the final approvals, and one of the senior leaders expressed concern as to which contracting office should, quote, get credit for the award. I remember this distinctly. You acknowledged the question and then very calmly said, "Mary, sometimes we just have to put on our Air Force hat." Now, I remember that because I've seen so many examples where we worry about who gets the credit instead of looking at the big picture and putting on that Air Force hat, as you so eloquently put it. So you've had a lot of strategic view that has served you well throughout your career. Do you have any other examples to share or anything to add with regard to thinking big picture at the sake of maybe sacrificing personal credit?
You know, what comes to mind when you relay that story is I've been on a couple of process improvement teams over the years. And in general, you know, you've got the one biggest one that was really huge had to do with changing the whole solicitation RFP process. And we had a lot of different representatives from everywhere. And what I, you know, people like to be able to come up with a good idea and say, "Hey, this is my idea." But what I love about teams is when you get together and you start discussing a problem and seeking solutions, you find the truth that is a quote that I really love: "No one is as smart as all of us." And I've attributed it to Bill Gates, but I've also read maybe it was Ken Blanchard who wrote a lot of management books. But it really is true. We all bring different perspectives, experience, and thoughts to the table. And if we listen to each other and we use a kind of yes and approach, good ideas snowball into becoming even better ideas. And it's a team solution, not an individual solution.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Great perspective there. And I really love the quote, "No one is as smart as all of us." So it just, you're always looking for that smartest person in the room sometimes. And sometimes it's more of a collective smart group as opposed to that one person. So great insight there. Thanks for sharing that. So, sir, you're clearly a man that likes to keep busy. And something our listeners may not know is that you've remained very active in NCMA, the National Contract Management Association. Not only a CFCM and an NCMA fellow, but you're also currently on the editorial advisory board for Contract Management Magazine. How important is it for our workforce to be part of a professional organization such as NCMA? For example, attorneys have the American Bar Association, realtors have the National Association of Realtors, and if you're in those professions, you're really expected to be a member of those associations. NCMA is sort of the association to be a part of for our profession, right?
Absolutely, without a doubt. And, you know, in addition to the roles you mentioned, I serve on NCMA's Board of Advisors, and I was also honored to be part of the Standards Consensus Body that finalized the second and third version of the American National Standards Institute's contract management standard. And this standard has become the framework for both DOD's and the Federal Acquisition Institute's professional training and certification program. And it's really exciting that the profession now has a consensus standard that provides common process and descriptions of the guiding principles, pre-award, award, and post-award processes of contract management. And I'm disappointed I won't be able to make it to this year's World Congress that's happening in Seattle in July. I have been to six of the last seven, including the virtual World Congress in 2020 when we were all holed up in our homes. And NCMA does a fantastic job of delivering these hybrid live and virtual conferences. So an event's happening in Seattle, but you can be sitting at your home and participate in about 80% of the conference. But I've always enjoyed the in-person opportunity because of the networking and just I like that in-person training much more. And it's just amazing to be in a room with 5,000 contracting professionals. And I always get something out of the conference. I also read every issue of Contract Management cover to cover. It keeps me up on changes and topics in the profession. And by the way, I guess by the time this gets posted, it'll be too late, but I'm doing a webinar for NCMA next week. And I think it'll be posted, so you may be able to see it recorded later. But anyways, join.
All right. No, excellent, sir. Yeah, looking forward to finding that webinar out there. And then for folks that maybe have not even heard of NCMA or they think it's just some global conglomerate, there's local chapters all over the place where folks could get involved, right?
Oh, yes. And particularly here in Dayton, we've got a very strong chapter. There's a couple of strong chapters in Virginia, Boston, and there's actually, I forget what they call it, a virtual chapter that is people who are spread out across the globe, really, where there isn't a local chapter. They created this virtual chapter that has virtual meetings, and so you can join that as well.
Yeah, awesome. So it's not something you just kind of pay your dues and then you put it on your resume, right? It's an opportunity to be engaged with your profession and other members of that profession. So yeah, great opportunity that really everybody needs to take a part of, I would say.
I totally agree. I've been a member since 1984.
Wow. Do you get a pin for that, sir? Do you get a...
Yeah, they changed the pins, but I do have a 40-year pin, actually.
Wow. Impressive. And again, it's great that you have stayed on, you know, past your government career and still remain active in such a huge role. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I found I have more time now that I'm retired. I work part-time now, so I have more time to be engaged in NCMA, and I just really enjoy it.
No, thanks again for giving back to the profession, if you will. So having worked for both government and industry at very high levels, what are some words of wisdom that maybe each side needs to know and appreciate about the other? For example, I'm sure our industry partners don't appreciate proposal due dates that fall around the holiday season, right? There's probably a few other golden nuggets there that we intentional or unintentionally irritate the other side. But what are some things that we just need to appreciate about each other?
Well, I think plenty of other contractors have commented on that solicitation drop on Christmas Eve. Even if you set a 60-day response date, you can be certain that people will begin working right away. So be kind. Don't do that. But what I would kind of stress is that we really need to see ourselves as being on the same team when it comes to delivering the results that the buyer is seeking when they award a contract. No company ever enters into an agreement without a sincere intent and desire to satisfy the customer's requirement. Of course, industry wants to make a reasonable profit, and we sometimes maybe offer too low a price to win the competition. But the real problems start when we're not working together cooperatively. I've provided consulting support to several firms who are struggling with getting a straight answer and a timely response out of their buying office. And at times, you know, phones aren't answered, emails aren't returned in a timely manner, or when you do get a response, it's ambiguous. And that leaves industry with questions about the contract requirements and no solutions. So when it comes to contracting issues, this is another one of my original quotes, I believe, they are not like fine wine, they never get better with age. Things need to be dealt with promptly and resolved as soon as possible, because time is money. And the sooner we can get these issues discussed and resolved, the better off both parties are in terms of the contract successful completion. So once a contract's awarded, particularly, we need to see ourselves as partners working together to ensure the work is completed in accordance with the requirements and have a common understanding of what those requirements are and where we disagree. We need to find agreement quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, the team approach, I've used this reference in another podcast as well, but a lot of time we talk about the industry side of the house and the government side of the house. And a lot of times we forget that, guys, it's all part of the same house, right? We are all under the same roof, and we are all trying to get, you know, that mission accomplished, get those, you know, materials or services to the warfighter. And then you mentioned, as far as communication goes, responsiveness. It seems like, I don't quite get it, it seems like we have more communication available at our fingertips now than we ever have, but it's harder to get a response, whether it's the industry side or the government side, right? We have emails, we have texts, we have instant messaging, we have social media, the old-fashioned telephone, for crying out loud. But it seems like we have more avenues for communication, but we tend to use them less and less. Any insights on that or any perceptions you might have seen?
Gosh, there's another podcast. So another Tom Wells original quote, I think email did the single greatest harm to productivity in the United States Air Force, because we're drowning in emails, but not real meaningful information. And, you know, I just, the volume of emails is just, people sit there all day and all they do is read emails, and then you send a short answer, but you're not having a conversation. And so talking to each other is so much more effective. You know, 10 minutes on the phone could be six emails back and forth, and all that time wasted reading, sorting, filing, deleting emails is frustrating. Of course, I've got four email accounts right now, so that makes it even worse, if you can imagine, right?
But yeah, the administrative time of, you know, some folks like to keep a clean email account, just kind of like the old fashioned inbox on the desk, right? You'd never let that grow into 1,000 different pieces of paper, but somehow that's how we manage our emails sometimes. Right. And everyone has their own filing system, but just the amount of administrivia and the administration time we put into that, you know, that's another time sucker. Absolutely. So moving on, sir, again, great insight, great discussion. So one of your current responsibilities at Dayton Aerospace is to develop and deliver acquisition training for both government and industry acquisition professionals. So I know when teaching government employees, you always incorporate a lesson on the phrase good enough for government work. Can you give our listeners some insight into that particular lesson and what that phrase means to you? Good enough for government work.
So it's never really in the syllabus, but I just can't ever end up a class of government employees without thanking them for their service. And I want to thank all of your listeners for all they do out there to support their organization and their mission, particularly those federal government DOD employees. Public service is a noble calling, and all of you and have earned that right to be proud of the work you do. Unfortunately, public service, especially at the federal level, doesn't always get the respect and thanks that it deserves. Many in the public, and even some of the people who are writing the laws that we have to execute in all these complex business arrangements we're in, they seem to enjoy denigrating those who serve and imply that the work we do is counter to public purposes, or are somehow we're lazy, do-nothing bureaucrats. And really, the federal agencies seem to take a lot more abuse compared to those of us, and I say us, because once you've worked for the Air Force, you always feel like you're part of the Air Force. But those who work for DOD get a lot more respect. My sister Wendy works for a federal agency, and when she's asked, what do you do for work? She says, well, I work for the federal government. And they say, oh, what do you do? She says, well, I work for the Department of the Treasury. And if they probe a little further, she starts talking about the weather, because she works for the IRS. And, you know, she knows that people are going to start ranting and raving at her if she says that. And And her job is actually, she's a taxpayer advocate. So her job is to help people who have troubles with tax issues and the IRS. And that's what she does. But she doesn't want to tell people she works for the IRS. And, you know, like her, she didn't write the rules that we have to operate in. They are all encoded in legislation, and it's difficult, very complex. And so I'm sure many of you have probably heard that phrase, good enough for government work. And to some, it might imply, you know, poor quality, slow service, little or no initiative, and bureaucrats seeking to avoid real work. Well, to me, that's a positive recognition. And I want to tell you why. The phrase was not uttered by government employees. It was said by contractor employees who were working on government contracts. No, I'm not saying bad things about government contractors, because I am one now. But a little context will help. If you think back to when the nation mobilized to respond to the war in Europe and World War II, the commitment was massive. Everyone knew a soldier, sailor, or Marine who went to war. Instead of Air Force airmen then, it was Army aviators or Air Corps members at the time. But over 400,000 U.S. military members would give their lives in this endeavor, and millions more were seriously injured in the fight. The industrial mobilization that occurred in the U.S. was larger than ever seen before or has been seen since. Military spending increased from about $400 billion, which was about 30% of the gross domestic product, to by 1944, it was $1.6 trillion, and it represented nearly 80% of the U.S. gross domestic product. So many fathers, sons, brothers, uncles, and quite a few sisters and daughters as well were called into service, and everyone knew someone who was over there. There was such a shortage of men to work in the factories that many women who had never had a full-time job stepped up to fill the gap. Rosie the Riveter, if you remember that, she became an employment advertisement and an enduring icon, calling women to serve their country. The general public was also sacrificing to support the war effort. Gas rationing, saving rubber, aluminum, practicing air raid responses, and in many cases, just doing without. And many companies that made consumer products converted their production capabilities to support the war effort. This one example is stunning. Ford produced about 3 million vehicles in 1939. During the war effort, they produced just 139 civilian vehicles. What were they making? Military vehicles and equipment. And they produced over 8,600 B-24 Liberator bombers. In the first year of the war, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt set a goal to produce about 3,000 aircraft. Over a period of just 4 years, the U.S. produced over 300,000 aircraft, including nearly 100,000 fighter pursuit aircraft, 96,000 bombers, 23,000 transport, and 58,000 trainers. And we needed this volume given the combat losses. We'd send out 15 bombers for one target, and we'd lose three or four of them in that one assault. And those bombers, heavy bombers, had 10-member crews on board. Now you look at and what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, we'd send out one B-1 or B-2 for three or four targets. You know, so it was quite a different situation then and now. But so contrary to people know that contractors are responsible for the quality control of their products and services they provide. And along the way, there are QC inspectors who confirm the products coming off the line are compliant, that they're good enough to support the troops that really needed this equipment. Products might have had minor defects, but it's good enough to meet the need and to perform the mission because it was done quickly and our country needed this equipment. So when I consider the work that all your listeners out there do, we are always under pressure to get things done quickly. And there's that tension between speed and quality. Doing the job right, complying with the complex regulations that govern our business, but meeting the need in a timely manner. Being driven by satisfying the warfighter's requirements is what drives us to innovate and maybe bend the rules just a little bit to apply the significant discretionary authority that contracting officers hold. So again, I thank you for what you do, and I encourage you to continue to press for speed and quality that is indeed good enough for government work and the mission we serve. Thank you once again for your service and support of national defense, the government, and the American people. That's my soapbox.
Oh, wow, sir. No, that's a great soapbox. And again, I knew the phrase was meant to be in a positive light, right? Hey, that's good enough for government work right there, as in, you know, that's a quality product. And somewhere it kind of became pejorative over the years. But I knew the history on it. I was not familiar with all those numbers and statistics. So I would encourage the listeners, maybe rewind a few seconds and take in those numbers, particularly Ford and the industrial mobilization. I mean, fascinating stuff, fascinating history, and underlying the importance, once again, of our profession. So excellent analogy, sir. Great history lesson and great perspective on that phrase, good enough for government work. So I think that was a great closing question. I think you wrapped things up extremely well. So, Mr. Wells, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and insight on The Contracting Experience. This has been a great conversation, and I'm grateful you could join us.
It's been a pleasure, Rob.
On behalf of The Contracting Experience Podcast, all of our listeners and subscribers, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure having you. And thank you to all of our podcast listeners, followers, and subscribers. If you have any feedback, suggestions for topics, or future guests you would like to hear on the podcast, you can submit those via email to thecontractingexperience@gmail.com. As a reminder, you can subscribe to the Contracting Experience podcast from any of your podcast listening platforms. Be sure to subscribe to receive updates and automatic downloads so you don't miss a single episode. I'm your host, Rob Lorton from the AFMC Contracting Digital Division, and I hope you can join us again on our upcoming episodes. Until then, stay tuned and stay connected.